don't frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on May 29th, 2017, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to discuss the upcoming UK election and the Labour Party campaign manifesto, as well as recent developments in the Central African Republic. Arsenal for Democracy is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me again in studio this week is Nate. Hi, Nate.
Great to be here, Bill.
So I just wanted to note up top that last week's show was about voter reform issues, and the day after we aired that episode, Democrats in Congress, in the House, did introduce a new bill for automatic voter registration and universal mail-in. There was already a bill regarding the ability to for everyone to mail in their ballots, but there was not yet a bill this session on automatic voter registration. So there is now a bill for that. So that's like a good thing that people can look up and support. But that was last week's topic. This week, we are starting out. We're going to be talking about the upcoming elections in the United Kingdom, where things are heating up a bit, getting a bit more dramatic. Remains to be seen if it's actually tightening in the polls. Pan out in reality, or if it's going to be kind of like France, where there was this whole dramatic flurry toward the end of the first round that didn't actually really bear out in reality. You never know how these things are going to go, and we're going to talk a little bit about kind of the complexities of the system and how it's kind of hard to know, you know, how it might turn out, whether or not the polls are even accurate, which is a whole other issue. There's been a lot of problems in the past couple of years with UK polling accuracy. So, Nate, where do we want to start on this UK election? What's a good point to begin on this?
Well, I mean, I guess there was a large sort of media to-do regarding the launch of the various manifestos. So a lot of stuff coming out about the Labour manifesto, which I guess was leaked a couple days early. So they basically got to launch it twice. And I think it's seems to have generally been pretty well received, pretty ambitious, bold, nationalizing a fair amount of different programs, including the rails, various energy sectors, water sector. There's a bunch of different reforms, including tuition-free university, things that we can get into, various tax increases on top earners, around top 5%, fat cat tax, various other types of national investment banks. So that's sort of a large, sort of bold proposal from Labour. There's the Tory manifesto that came out as well. There was a UKIP manifesto. We just saw we were researching this for this. So that's sort of been a big focus recently. But then, of course, there was a terrorist attack that happened in Manchester not too long ago, and that sort of has somewhat altered the last days of the campaign here. But so those are sort of the main things. I was just watching, actually, the I guess it was a public town hall that was held, not with necessarily a debate, but they interviewed both Corbyn and Prime Minister Theresa May. So that's where we are right about now with the election coming up on June 6th.
It's June 8th.
Okay. Not a mistake.
Yeah, so I think, you know, we can talk about some of the Manchester attack in a bit, but I do want to talk first about the manifestos and especially the details of the Labour manifesto. I think the funniest thing for me was all the people who said, said as if this was some sort of attack that was going to really resonate. Can you believe that this manifesto for the Labour Party was written by the labor unions? And it was just like, yeah, I mean, not only is it called the Labour Party and founded by labor unions originally, but the labor unions still have an institutional role in the party in a way that is not true of, say, unions in the Democratic Party in the United States, right? There's quite literally major union input on, you know, the election of leaders and things like that within the Labour Party. And the notion that this was some sort of special interest cabal that was allowed to come in and write this is pretty funny. And then, of course, as Nate said, it was very well received in terms of the details of the manifesto. The public seems really excited by it in a way that was not predicted originally. And, you know, it's like, well, I guess you can attack this as being written by the trade unions or something, but apparently that's what the public wants. So, or at least the labor leaning public wants.
Right. And I guess, the thing that we're seeing in the U.S., of course, over the past several decades is the declining institutional power of labor within the Democratic Party. And then maybe sometimes where it does exist, maybe they don't feel too connected to the Democratic Party. Just so, for example, today, walking around here in Massachusetts, saw a car with a Trump sticker on it, but also a union sticker. So that's sort of, that's sort of the contrast there. Of course, with the Blairites have certainly brought neoliberalism to the Labour Party, but that's being pushed back on now, I guess. So to get into the details of this manifesto, talking about taking over the trusteeship, which would effectively nationalize various rail services, I guess, and it's been a while since I was on the British rails, but I guess there are some government-owned rail systems, particularly around London and Liverpool, Merseyside area, and this would potentially, instead of them going into receivership or however exactly it works, the government would just take those over. Energy sector, Corbyn said he wanted there to be at least one public energy company in every region in the UK, and I guess there already are several of them in several regions, basically to expand that. Looking for potentially a ban on fracking to go with a new public water sector. So sort of similar to the energy sectors, maybe not all the water companies would be publicly owned, but there would be a significant chunk of it be publicly owned. Rising minimum wage to £10 an hour, nationalize the mail service, have a various more of a robust national care service, which would allow, you know, people to get childcare. One issue that was being debated, and of course is a hot button issue for the Tories as well, would be immigration. And the Tories have pledged to cut immigration down to tens of thousands compared to the, I guess, hundreds of thousands that are coming in currently. But the labor leaders, including various shadow secretaries and such, have said, the issue of the economy is actually going to be more important than immigration. So we're going to let that fluctuate depending what the economy needs. And I guess they're estimating it would go down somewhat, but maybe not to the tens of thousands that the Tories are promising, although there's debate over whether they can actually hit that target as well. So another part of it concerns about £30 billion going into the NHS. They're looking at ending the 1% nurse pay cap, as well as, I guess, abolishing some parking charges if you're going to go park at the NHS facility. So there's a sort of laundry list here, a bunch of different things, including a Ministry of Labor that they're proposing to establish. Included in that would be things like banning unpaid internships or zero-hour contracts, things like that, to basically secure more workers' rights. So there's a lot of different stuff going on here, but it seems to have a general coherent theme. It's not just sort of all sort of things slapped together. More of a just building up more of a robust welfare state, or a way for people to just not be have their livelihood slashed away at a bit by bit through austerity, but rather have a more of a broad-based social program that everyone can benefit from. So,
yeah, and I think you were emphasizing off air before the episode that, you know, the accusation tends to be that labor, you know, wants to build this huge welfare state that, you know, people are just going to be dependent on. But in reality, this manifesto is really giving a lot of people the opportunity to stand on their own two feet and you know, and thrive, regardless of the welfare state, so to speak, or at least that the welfare state is supposed to be assistive, not like, you know, completely just dominant.
I was watching an interview on BBC where the interviewer was very hostile towards, I guess it was the shadow economy secretary or whatnot, and talking about, oh, this was going back to the 70s. Oh, and why won't you say that you're going to make the state bigger? And the guy was sort of, okay, I'm not going to let myself get framed into that. And then basically pivoted to saying, okay, this is actually about making sure people have a broader base of support that they can use to, you know, go further in their own lives, and not, you know, this is less about having the state bear down on people and more about providing a broad base of support so they can actually send their kids to childcare, or, you know, not, you know, this is a bit different from the United States, but making sure that there are no further cuts to NHS or various other programs that people rely upon, but at the same time, the Tories may, you know, have further austerity towards.
Right. And this agenda is basically to build a state that helps take care of your basic needs and concerns and fears as, you know, a citizen or a parent or whatever, in terms of your material security. It's providing that material security and then gets out of the way so that you can, you know, thrive and survive in the rest of the economy. A lot of that, like you said, is focusing on wages and contract issues and things like that. You know, certainly the thing that I think often drives the critique of this is going back to the 70s or something is the inclusion of pushing for renationalization of the railways. Although, as I understand it, that was in Tony Blair's 1997 manifesto as well. They never did it. But like the notion that this is some sort of, you know, radical departure for labor going way back in time is just not realistic. Obviously, that was 20 years ago, but that was, you know, the other wing of the party proposing that. And the reason is that in Britain, they had at some point, you know, privatized the rail system, or most of it, and it's bad. It's very expensive. The service is terrible. There's a lot of times like people will find their commuter train canceled and things like that. A lot of times people have done experiments lately where like you could fly to Spain and then back to a different part of Britain for less than it costs you to go on the train between those two points.
Yeah, with like the cheap Ryanair flights and the EasyJets.
Right, and now some of that is obviously an effect of like the deregulation of airlines and things like that, and that has its own abuses. But the fact that it's just absurdly expensive to go, you know, relatively short distances, I mean, I think my understanding is that you can, you know, go probably further across the U.S. for less money on Amtrak, you know, which is publicly owned, than going on a lot of these private rail services across relatively short distances in a much smaller country. And so people are just really fed up with this. And the reality of it, and this is maybe for another episode where we can go more into depth about it, but the reality is that transit, public transit economics tend to favor public ownership, you know, a single state corporation or something like that. They're not very good for competitive free market practices because that tends to force them to build out, like, and that's happened in the United States certainly too, before the, you know, they realized that they couldn't actually sustain this and went to the Amtrak model. But you would have like, you know, you have railroads, either you give the private companies a monopoly over a certain geographic area from the government, in which case they have no incentive to do the supposedly great things the free market does, or they build rival rail lines next to each other, which is just a huge waste. You know, it's very expensive to build that. It requires a lot of land, that sort of thing, when you could just have one. So generally, it's like a natural monopoly that favors having public ownership and control. Obviously, you want to have very rigorous oversight and controls on that so that it's, you know, not some overbearing monopoly that doesn't serve the public interest. But the idea that this is some sort of radical proposal is A, untrue from an economic standpoint, and B, untrue from a public support standpoint. And so, you know, that's an example of something where the media has this one perspective and the public just isn't seem to go along with it, really.
Yeah, and I guess plus they're promising to add Wi-Fi onto the train. So, I mean, that's actually not really that small of a bonus. I mean, because if you have that, maybe you're going to work or whatnot. So, I mean, that could be a real benefit.
Now, so like the polling has definitely improved for Labor quite a bit. It's, you know, there's been some polls that show, you know, 5 or 6 points difference between the Conservatives still in the lead and the Labor Party. So that's good. And I think I believe that despite, you know, Jeremy Corbyn's having some struggles with genuine struggles with organizational leadership issues, and also, of course, obviously just being stabbed in the back constantly by some of his own members, but he is probably one of the few candidates that could have gotten Labour to this point in the polling. I would say, though, I'm still pretty skeptical about the ultimate outcome of the election, even if let's assume for this purposes that the polls are accurate and that this is approximately the percentage that you'll get. The issue is that, you know, as in the United States with seats in parliament, you know, whoever comes in first in a given district, you know, even without 50% or whatever, they win that seat. So you have to geographically concentrate your votes enough that you win seats and spread them out enough that you are winning a lot of seats as opposed to, you know, just being very geographically limited. The reality that for some reason almost never comes up in the discussions of this, you know, there was always this, oh, look how bad Labour's doing in the polling, et cetera, for years and blaming this on Corbyn. The reality is that this is what we call Labour without Scotland. There used to be about 50 seats or so that Labour could count on to win in Scotland. Those are now all SNP seats, and for the foreseeable future probably will remain Scottish National Party seats. And, you know, the Scottish National Party sometimes portrays itself as kind of left-wing. Really, it's mostly just normal social democratic, and even some people have argued Blairite. I think that there's not really a good reason to be voting for them in a national election, you know, for Westminster, but regardless, people are going to vote for them. You have to understand that. That means that Labour is automatically kind of working from a deficit in terms of seats. That would be true regardless of who the leader was, whether it's Corbyn, whether it's someone from, you know, the Blair wing of the party, something like that. In order for the Labour to lead the government, they have to come in ahead of the Conservatives in the number of seats. I don't know if that's going to happen. At the moment, they're still trailing in the polling. But again, it's less about the percentage that you're getting, right, and more, yeah, about, you know, how many seats you're getting, that sort of thing. And then there's a question of like, well, if they came in first, they almost certainly wouldn't have a majority. You know, so who would they work with? The Lib Dem leadership is pretty crazy and also looks like it will be quite small in terms of the actual number of seats. The SNP, you could work with them, but they're probably going to make a lot of demands regarding Scotland. You know, these are the kind of concerns that Labour would actually face.
The SNP had, I think, said that she was open to sort of a progressive alliance or something like that. So, but I think that would probably only impact if it were pretty close, I guess, if it was sort of a hung parliament. One thing I want to note that Theresa May did say, I think maybe it was just today, was that they were fearing falling behind in a poll. And so you wonder, are they just saying that to sort of temper expectations or to ward off the damage if that does happen? Or so I don't know exactly where their head's at. It is worth noting, though, that it hasn't been a great couple of weeks for Theresa May. She was hammered on, I guess there was a dementia tax that became a big thing, and she sort of U-turned on that a little bit and sort of blew up in her face. Then she was also confronted by a disabled woman. I watched a little bit of this video. Just this woman didn't realize that Theresa May was going to come to her township or whatever and confronted her on the streets over cuts to disabled benefits, saying it's like, I have some learning disabilities, I have various other disabilities, this is terrible, it's going to be horrible for me. And it was really hard to watch. I mean, this woman was clearly struggling, and Theresa May was just sort of spouting platitudes, didn't really have any answers. And so, I mean, that's sort of the kind of visual thing that it's not going to be great for. I don't know if it's really going to swing the difference. I'm trying to not be overconfident here or anything. So,
but the May government has been terrible on a lot of these really,
especially
basic
after
issues.
The terrorist attack too, it hasn't really gone well for her. People were predicting that would really lead to a Tory spike in the polls or something. That hasn't really happened. We could talk a little bit about the terror speech that Corbyn gave or some of the other issues.
Yeah, well, let's get into that in just a bit. But, you know, regarding the disabilities cuts, I mean, one of the sort of hallmarks of this government, you know, especially under Theresa May, even before she became prime minister, but, you know, also definitely as prime minister, has been these horrible disability cuts where they basically say, as long as you can, like, meet the minimum functioning, you know, or whatever, then you don't get benefits or you get severe reductions in benefits. There have been cases where people needed like a car basically or a car service to help them get to places. And they said, well, no, we're going to take that away from you because of X, Y, and Z reasons. And then it's like, but once you've taken that away, now that person, you know, the things that were working for them and going well in their life, that immediately collapses. And now they're back to a situation of qualifying to have the car again, you know. And it's just these horrible cycles, saying that, you know, even if you're in total agony, you know, with some sort of like, you know, autoimmune thing or, you know, a chronic pain issue or something, well, it doesn't matter. As long as you're, you know, able to go sit at your desk and whatever and do the work, then too bad you have to go do that. And, you know, just a lot of this stuff that just keeps adding up and adding up, and a lot of, you know, people with children with disabilities and special needs having a lot of trouble, that sort of thing.
Yeah, there was another sort of gaffe like this talking about food banks. And I guess there was a Tory MP, Dominic Raab or something like that, was talking about how people that use food banks in Britain, they're not poor. They just have a cash flow problem, which I'm not quite sure what the difference is there. But apparently food bank usage has been going up over the past 9 years in Britain. And I think at one point I was watching Corbyn speak, and he was talking about how we don't want to be food bank Britain, talking about how further austerity will lead to people falling back on food banks. We want to make sure that we want to have these things as a last resort for people, not as something that everyone's being forced to fall back on because there's not enough for everybody. And, you know, clearly Labour is, you know, with the for the many, not the few is their tagline there. So I think that sort of feeds into this, and you have further gaffes by these sort of aristocratic Tories that are not really in touch with people's needs.
And Theresa May continues to refuse to debate Corbyn, as I understand it, right? I don't think they've actually had a head-to-head yet. They've done like these town hall things like we saw with Clinton and Sanders, but not, you know, the difference being that you're not
they
side
weren't on
by
stage
side
at the same time,
right? You're not asking each other questions like prime minister's questions, that sort of thing. And that's sort of remarkable. And I think a lot of voters are like, "What? Why are you not debating? You know, whatever." But also, man, I mean, this is so funny though. If it comes out anything close to what the polling is indicating, this election was specifically called early. They had to repeal the Fixed Term Parliaments Act to do this election early, instead of waiting the full 5 years. And she called this election early to increase her majority because the Conservatives had, you know, won this surprise majority in the last election, but it was only, I think, about maybe a 5-seat margin or something like that. It's very, very narrow, their actual control of Parliament. But she called this election in order to increase her majority. The stated reason supposedly was that she wanted more, you know, hardcore Brexit Conservatives elected. Partly that's an issue of needing to purge the party of very pro-EU members that were going to obstruct her on a quote-unquote hard Brexit. But partly it's just a matter of that even if you're not purging the existing members, you need to get more of those members who will support hard Brexit. You know, my boss has speculated, I don't know if he's published it yet, but you know, has at least speculated to me that there's sort of a secondary motive here, which is that May is an old school Thatcherite who, you know, came of age kind of as Margaret Thatcher was rising to power. Not, I mean, she wasn't like a teenager, but, you know, this was her early political career coincides with Margaret Thatcher's tenure as prime minister starting. And that the people who are willing to do a quote unquote hard Brexit, like a really hard, you know, like getting almost nothing from the EU and just like leaving and walking away. And, you know, it's going to cause all kinds of economic dislocation and disruption. That sort of like shock doctrine thing that those MPs would be willing to endorse also probably means that they're more willing to endorse things like, you know, demolishing the NHS or finishing off public housing, things like that. And that was kind of the argument that my boss was making is like, in theory, this is an election about affirming the Brexit result and making it a really hard Brexit as opposed to a softer Brexit like Labour has promised. But in reality, it's more about just building up enough Conservative MPs who won't be reluctant to make to finish the job that Thatcher began. And then despite all of this, it now looks like the Conservatives may end up losing their majority. And a lot of, as I understand it from inside sources that I have in Britain, there were, before this snap election was called, there were conservative strategists, and I heard this before the election was called, so it's not just them spinning. There were conservative strategists who said they absolutely did not want her to call an early election. So there's two big risks for the conservatives, you know, aside from actual labor, you know, gaining dominance or whatever here. The two big risks are, one, that the liberal Democrats were running on this, like, no, we shouldn't do Brexit at all, which is a totally unrealistic campaign, right? It's totally meaningless, and you can't undo that result. However, that might be enough to steal back some of those seats that the conservatives had won in the last election when the Lib Dems collapsed. That doesn't look like it's actually going to happen, but that was a fear ahead of time. The bigger thing, and this is something that just, like, you really have to question why Theresa May called this election when she did. So, you know, in the United States, we have redistricting that happens every 10 years or so after the census, that kind of thing. There was a redistricting coming up for the UK. By almost all accounts, it was going to transfer about maybe six or more seats automatically to the Conservatives just by redrawing them into much more favorable districts. And that would be done by the Independent Redistricting Commission. It wouldn't be, you know, it's not like partisan gerrymandering to, you know, rig this. It just happens that where the population had moved, blah, 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 it was going to probably generate some really additional safe seats for the Conservatives. That would have been available if they had waited the full 5 years to the next election. But instead, she calls this early election, they don't get to benefit from that, and, you know, this is potentially screwing her over. So it is sort of remarkable that she calls this early election, and then just it looks like things are really falling apart. That being said, as much as we've talked about the trouble that Labour might have trying to form a government, I don't know what happens if the Tories try to form a government, you know, after this election, if they lose their majority and it's a hung parliament, because what it looks like right now is that they will come in first, but potentially with less than a majority, if we're lucky, I guess. But that the Liberal Democrats, who are the most likely to be able to go into coalition with them, won't have enough seats to really do that. And the Liberal Democrats, as weird and creepy as their current leader is, and he's pretty conservative himself. He's like this convert to sort of a, I think, like evangelical Christianity or something like that, and has some sort of like all kinds of weird issues like opposing gay marriage and stuff that even the Tories don't do anymore. You know, even setting aside that like personal drama, I think a lot of Liberal Democrats, as much as they might be happy to just get back into power in some form because that was unusual for them, I think it's going to be a little bit weird for them to try to go back into coalition after they know that the last time they did that, they almost got eliminated. So they, you know, if they go back in one more time, they may cease to exist as a party, which is fine. I don't care because I don't like the Lib Dems.
Who needs them?
But I just, you know, it's going to be interesting to see, no matter how this plays out, how they actually form a government, unless someone actually manages to win a majority. And that is definitely, like, for all the mocking of the U.S. Electoral College and everything, I will say that it's, you know, Britain has its own issues too, right? Because they have a system where, you know, a party could get significantly less than 50% of the popular vote and easily command a majority. And it's just totally based on where the votes happen to be. The other sort of big phenomenon in this election is the question, and this will lead us into the terrorism issue, is the question of where the UKIP voters are going, because UKIP as a party, United Kingdom Independence Party, has lost its sort of raison d'etre because it was supposed to get Brexit from the EU, and that happened. So, you know, now there's concern that a lot of them would go back to voting for the Conservatives, and that would help with, you know, building up the majority. Now maybe not, in light of this terrorist attack in Manchester and sort of Theresa May's personal role in that. Do you want to talk briefly about that, and then we'll go to a break?
Yeah, I guess first just saying UKIP's poll numbers have been going down a little bit, and some of them have been going to the Tories, but we'll see after this terrorist attack. So yeah, I mean, we all saw was 22 dead, suicide bombing in at a concert in Manchester Arena. Details are coming out about the guy who did it. I guess Salman, we don't really know how to pronounce his last name, Abid or something like that. So, and I guess it's now coming out that he had gone to fight in Libya when he was only 16.
British kid gets sent at 16 to go fight in Libya.
During the war there that was, you know, we all...
Cameron and Sarkozy's war.
Exactly. So, you know, from a U.S. perspective, a lot is focused on Obama and Hillary. But if you go back to it was actually those two guys, Sarkozy And, you know, with Theresa May as Home Secretary, I guess people pushing to go into Libya. And then eventually Obama's like, OK, well, we'll go along with this. And the U.S. eventually got heavily involved there. But so this guy was there. I guess he was involved, with the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, probably picked up some skills, some various types of terrorist planning abilities down there. Recently went back, within the last year. He had been back to Libya. So, I mean, this is kind of what happens when you create war zones where you have people, disaffected youths from Western European countries. They flood into these war zones, pick up various abilities to become terrorists, remain disaffected. Maybe they can't reintegrate back into life when they go back to England or wherever. And for some, this doesn't happen to everyone, but at the same time, it does happen. So, and I guess, after this terrorist attack, there was a large police presence on the streets. It seemed like May was trying to really use this, and it kind of backfired on her, to the extent where I guess there were even conservative publications sort of mocking her, portraying her in like body armor with assault rifles and such. Corbyn gave a speech where he was sort of outlining how British foreign policy can actually create terrorism, warning against this type of blowback. And I guess there were some opinion polls that you mentioned to me, Bill, and I saw them as well, saying the British public overwhelmingly, or not overwhelmingly, but by a significant majority, agrees with Corbyn on this sort of key issue over whether, you know, the continued interventions can eventually make us all less safe. And sort of agreeing with is, okay, we need to find a way to get tough on the causes of terrorism in addition to just, you know, tracking down people that are, you know, about to commit acts of terrorism. So,
and he's been getting criticized because of some segment in 2011 where he was saying that he didn't think the assassination of bin Laden was a good idea. And, there was some wording that I wouldn't have necessarily agreed with, but overall what he said was just that he believed that he should have been hunted down and brought to trial, and that there wasn't an attempt made to do that as far as anyone could tell. And he always said, you know, and this is the same thing that he's saying in this speech here, is you can only fight this stuff with the rule of law and those sort of civilizational norms rather than more war, you know, and he's opposed a lot of these wars in the past. I think it's great though that the polling seems to indicate again that the public is agreeing with him. You know, he's saying a quote unquote unserious thing in a major speech, and then the public agrees with him anyway.
That just sort of tells you what is and what is not actually unserious. I mean, I'd argue that Theresa May just saying everything, we must be strong and stable, I mean, that's unserious. That's there's no attempt to engage with, you know, the history of terrorism and how it affects Western European countries, or say America for that matter. I mean, there's really nothing there other than just being, oh, we're going to get the bad guys, get them, and that's it. So, you know, I think the fact that Corbyn can actually go up there and articulate a foreign policy vision that incorporates these factors into it, especially right after a terrorist attack like that, and have the public broadly agree with him, I think that's a significant step forward, and I guess very different than maybe say 10, 15 years ago, although, you know, there were massive anti-Iraq war protests in England as well.
Which she was part of.
Yeah. So, and I believe he was actually interrupted by Chelsea Clinton in one of them. So not to get not to get too deeply into that, but.
Okay. Any closing thoughts on this topic?
I'm trying not to get overexcited. Hopefully Corbyn can win. But if he doesn't, I think this is still certainly better than how it was looking couple of months ago, so that's certainly not nothing.
All right, well, we will be back in just a moment from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. Please stick around. Democracy. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill, and still in studio with me is Nate. We're going to talk now about the Central African Republic, and it's something we've talked about previously on arsenalfordemocracy.com. A lot of other shows probably don't cover this kind of thing, but we do feel it's important to return to this subject periodically and update folks. you know, obviously it's been quite a few years since we were doing some pretty significant segments on it. So Nate, why don't you recap for us a little bit what happened back around like 2013 that sort of kicks off this this narrative, and then what happened after that, that and then sort of the more recent stuff.
Yeah, so going back to 2013, I guess in March, President Francois Bazize had been ousted by Islamist Seleka rebels, where, you know, they had sort of taken over large swaths of the country, set up a government, basically. But shortly thereafter, there was the French intervention as well, and it has now sort of devolved into, over the past couple years, various warlords, militia groups, all fighting amongst each other. The Seleka has broken up into various different groups that occasionally will fight each other. And there's also been the rise of a Christian militia known as the Anti-Balaka. And it has devolved basically into, you know, there are people being killed by militia groups on all different sides. There's a large internally displaced population. I guess about one-fifth of the country is now internally displaced. A lot of Muslims have been fleeing from the Christian more eastern or western part of the country, rather, and so there's been a large population displacement. I guess about 100,000 displaced just from one region since September, and this there's been lots of deaths, including various attacks on. There's currently a UN mission there as well as attacks on aid workers, Red Cross, World Food Program, other NGOs have been attacked. So that's sort of the situation we are in right now, just with a lot of different conflicts, a lot of times over resources such as diamonds, gold mines, cattle even. So that's sort of where we are right now, with just all sorts of various human tragedy, people being sheltered in mosques and churches to prevent them from being killed by various militia groups, and attacks this, in the past couple of weeks. I guess there were 7 UN peacekeepers and workers, engineers, who were killed in various attacks. So yeah, that's sort of what's going on right now.
There was basically, it was termed back in 2013, the acts of reciprocal genocide was a phrase that came up. Reciprocal genocide is the concept in places like the Balkans or Rwanda or wherever, less so in Rwanda, where basically first one side starts committing a genocide against an ethnic or religious minority, and then the other side, you know, arms up and starts committing it against random civilians and, you know, that sort of thing. And as you said, there, you know, there was the Muslim militias and the Christian militias, and then there were these allegations, you know, by Human Rights Watch at the time about things that were going on. That's always a little dicey, because Human Rights Watch sometimes, you know, has its own agenda and can manipulate certain stuff.
Yeah.
But it seemed pretty credible, yeah, that that had been what was happening here. So, okay, so what should we be talking about now on this story? What's the thing that people need to know now?
Well, I mean, I guess over the past couple of weeks, as I mentioned, there was an uptake in attacks on the actual UN mission itself. There were 5 Cambodian engineers killed. And I guess, you know, they're involved with often taking out mines or just building bridges, things like that. And also a bunch of Moroccans were also involved in that deployment. 2 were killed in, I guess, attacks by the Anti-Balaka, who are, you know, they're interesting. They sort of fuse animist traditions. They wear like symbols and sort of like charms and totems, and they think they can't be shot by like a AK or hacked by a machete or something, so that leads them maybe a little bit more fearless in battle or something, just a way to get themselves amped up. So that's been happening. And, you know, there was, I guess, a couple years back, there was an attempt to form a government. They have a prime minister now, Faustin, I guess, Arshans Touadera, probably pronouncing that wrong. But so there is a government in place now, but the main thing, I think, is the UN is trying to get various combatants to renounce violence, turn in their weapons, and, you know, sort of work on projects to rebuild parts of the country. And, I mean, that's happening, but at the same time, there persists various militia groups, oftentimes, as I mentioned, tied to various warlords who are ruling diamond mines. There's, you know, obvious, very lucrative trade there, potentially access to gold. Various gold warlords may have been using their using U.S. financial institutions to sort of launder money through. I mean, that's something we've seen before with involving other terrorist groups. So that's something that's been happening. And I guess in general, part of the issue we're seeing is Muslims have been displaced from the west of the country. And there's one, the city of Bangui, there was a Muslim population of about 130,000, and that's now down to about 1,000. Many of them just had to flee the country, or, you know, either flee to a neighboring country or flee to the more Muslim-friendly, I guess, east of the country. And, you know, that sort of goes into a larger issue that, you know, we've talked about maybe a little bit before on this show, but it often seems like when there's violence, or sort of, especially on the larger scale, against Muslims, that's really not focused on in the media as much, whether it's here, whether it's in somewhere like against the Rohingya Muslims. So, you know, that's something that we should probably be focusing on more, just because, you know, the media in large doesn't really talk about that. Or they will talk about violence against Muslims, but only certain types of Muslims that are, you know, geopolitically convenient for the interests that control mainstream media here, or, you know, in the rest of the Western world. So if there's attacks on Shia Muslims that are inconvenient for us, those really aren't covered as much, whether, you know, it's in Yemen where people are starving, or there was actually an incident in Syria where, I guess, terrorists were handing out crisps and like chips to little kids, and then they blew up the buses right next to where all these little kids are. But I guess since they were allegedly regime supporters, they aren't worth really... CNN literally described the bombing as a blip. So, you know, probably not the language they would be using if they were rebel supporting kids who had been blown up, but not to get too deeply into Syria here. So I think it is important to note what's going on right now in Central African Republic. This continues to be a conflict. There's, I guess there's about 12,000 UN peacekeepers there. And, you know, you have to hope that they find ways to, you know, re-engage some of these militias. I saw a picture of a lot of guns that have already been turned in from various ex-Seleka militias. But they still have a lot of guns out there. Anti-Balaka still has a lot of guns and machetes still out there. So, you know, we need to try to find ways. And there's going to be possibly continued cuts to the United Nations if this Trump budget goes through. That's sort of up in the air now. But, you know, these are the kind of things that are the end result of sort of our contribution to the UN or our contribution to various aid programs. They're actually the things that are getting, like, say, rice to people that are sheltering in UN aid camps, because if they go outside the aid camp, the militias will attack them at night. So,
and that's sort of, I think, one of the complications with the sort of UN role in this and the peacekeeper role in this country, is that on the one hand, there's very clear benefits like you're talking about. On the other hand, there's been a lot of abuses.
Yeah.
Those are very severe. You had French peacekeepers that are been widely implicated in child sexual abuse and trafficking, that sort of thing. There were allegations, you know, back in 2014 or so, that, you know, that the militias, the Christian militias, were, you know, cutting up like corpses in front of the French peacekeepers with no sort of intervention or anything on their part. But as you said, you know, there's also these protective bases and handing out food and things like that. And I don't know why the UN can't seem to clean up its house, and that even the best intended missions, you know, that are supposed to be doing good, they just seem to still have all these horrible issues and problems and abuses and stuff like that. I don't know what the solution there is, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously an extreme problem, and it's not just been this deployment. There's been many in the past, issues surrounding sexual abuse, and also, as you mentioned, just failing to intervene when there's atrocities going on right in front of you. I guess there was, thinking back to the Balkans, there was an infamous incident where the UN peacekeepers didn't even take out their headphones when they saw, you know, people being genocide happening right in front of them. So this is an issue that, you know, continues to be a problem. Recently appointed UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, he said this is going to be a priority for him in terms of reform. Obviously, you know, we need to, you know, make sure that that actually gets done so we can judge him on his record. It's a little early right now, but at the same time, this is the kind of thing that needs to be tackled immediately. So this is the these are the issues that we really want to see push going forward at the UN, and we want to see, you know, further action both by donating countries such as the United States to make sure that actually aid is getting to the people that desperately need it on the ground. And there's, you know, you actually have situations, because the people that are coming into these camps, often these camps get swarmed and there's only like a couple guys on patrol with maybe light weapons, and sometimes they'll just get attacked by large militia groups where they're completely outgunned for the most part. So that's an issue we have to keep looking at. And I guess another issue is that there's been allegations involving child soldiers, often, you know, quite drugged up, where they're being included in some of these militia groups. And, you know, they're, you know, this is obviously an issue we're seeing in a lot of war zones, but child soldiers is another, it's pretty horrifying situation.
How does this UN mission in Central African Republic compare to the one that you talked about a month or so ago in Mali? I'm guessing this is a less aggressive mission in terms of, you know, operational authority and that sort of thing. That one was, you know, as we talked about, was sort of a more offensive mission, like in Congo.
Right. Well, you know, they actually have much more of a counterinsurgency focus in that. And I guess because that's more focused against one enemy or one group of enemies, whereas here it's sort of trying to much more keep the peace against multiple different groups that could all be potentially attacking both civilians and UN peacekeeping forces. But this is sort of going in that direction. They don't quite have the situation where they're getting in tons of drones or various helicopters or anything like that. But that is something that we should probably be focusing on going forward, is does this begin to more resemble the deployment that's going on in Mali right now? So I guess I want to zoom out maybe a little bit and talk about how basically since the beginning of the fighting in 2013, nearly 900,000 Central Africans have been displaced. And so many of them are going into, as I mentioned, churches, mosques, UN positions, fleeing into neighboring Cameroon or Chad. And just in the past several weeks, I guess, the UN has estimated that about 15,000 have fled for their homes in both the towns of Bengaso and the town of Alindo. So about 130 are currently confirmed dead. So that's just in the past couple of weeks. There also have been Doctors Without Borders warnings that this could be a return to the level of violence not seen since the conflict's peak in 2014. So it seems like the past couple months have been really an uptick in violence. So that's another huge part of worry. So, I mean, the UN forces have been attacked several times. They came in under heavy attack in by nearly 700 anti-Balaka militia members in firefights back on May 13th after they had attacked Muslim civilians. They responded with a push towards various neighborhoods, taking strategic positions and securing a mosque where civilians had been sheltering. So, you know, they're engaging in sort of urban combat and trying to reach various strategic positions that, you know, refugees have been sheltering at. So, I mean, I've watched some videos where they talk with various priests who have taken in Muslim refugees. And, you know, then you go outside of the church and you see people talking about how they want to kill the Muslims. So it's pretty unstable. And, you know, there's all, and it was interesting hearing people describe the problems, or just going the history back. And a lot of times or a lot of towns, the just Christian Muslim distinction, that wasn't a huge deal. You had a lot of people, just, it was very normal. People lived next to each other. And then once various cycles of violence, as you mentioned, started happening, the chasm just started to grow in between the various groups. And now it's much more difficult to envision a situation like it used to be before the fighting, although hopefully that can happen in the future. But as you mentioned, once various ethnic groups start attacking each other, and there are, of course, ethnic conflicts below the sort of Christian-Muslim distinction that also come into play here.
Sectarian or ethnic or tribal. And
so there have been, I guess, going back to Bozize, there was accusations he was favoring certain ethnic groups over others. So that also comes into play here. You have various Exelica militias all fighting each other, but some are more representative of certain ethnic groups. I guess Fulani is, I guess, one ethnic group that one ex-Seleka group is largely composed of, and there have been ethnic conflicts over that. So it's very multidimensional here. In many cases, a lot of these militias are involved with warlords who are, you know, involved with diamond mines or gold mines, or just I'm not sure the level of cobalt or other types of minerals that are there, but certainly those come into play as well. So these are, you know, there's all sorts of various things. And, you know, the UN peacekeepers, there are about 12,000 of them, but as I mentioned before, pretty lightly armored, especially in comparison to the Mali operation. So it seems likely that there's probably going to be a continuation of conflict there. And, you know, as UN peacekeeping funds are possibly on the chopping block in the future here in the United States, you sort of wonder what the effects could be on a mission like this.
All right. Well, Nate, thank you so much for joining me on Arsenal for Democracy this week.
Thanks, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD, WVUD HD1, and WVUD HD2 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.